Whether you're splitting a ride to the stadium or grabbing nachos for the group, Venmo makes it easy to share the fun and split the bill in the app. Sign up today with promo code SBNation and get $10 to send and spend. Offer ends December 31st, 2021. Limited availability. See terms at venmo.me/signup10.
And welcome back to From Corbin to Coruscant, a Mason Avenue's Mylorian podcast.
There we go. I like this rebrand.
I'm joined this week by Lucas Vlahos and Thomas Henderson. And it's probably for the best this week that Ken isn't here.
Yeah. So, fun little fact here. I was at my girlfriend's place before we were recording this. And originally I was thinking, oh, well, I'll just stay here and I'll, like, hop on to do the podcast real quick and it'll be fine. And then I realized, wait, we're going to be talking about Star Wars and I'm slowly bringing her through the animated stuff. I can't spoil the things. I better go home. So at, like, 8:25, I realized this. I'm like, oh, shit, I got to go. And just, like, sprinted the 3 blocks home.
See, that's dedication, folks.
Dedication to the bit.
That is. It really is.
All right, so we'll start things with promote, extend, trade. And as we all know, obviously, the Omicron variant is in the U.S. now, and it's presumably spreading, and obviously you don't want to catch that. So what other three communicable diseases are we going to promote, extend, or trade here?
Jesus fucking Christ.
First, we have Gamorrean mumps. Next, we have Rat Ghoul Plague. And last are the Nerf Pox.
The Nerf Pox? I don't actually know what that one is.
Well, I can tell you. You do not want to catch Nerf Pox.
Nerf Pox? Is this...
I don't think I want to catch any of these, to be honest with you.
No.
Nerf Pox is a virus that affected Alderaanian youths. Trevor Insavade caught it in 22 before Battle of Yavin.
That's tough,
this?
Right before the battle.
What the hell is this?
Steve's breaking up the stuff not even in the canon anymore.
Like, I would have expected you to pull out, like, the blue shadow virus or something. I'd be like, yeah, I don't want that. That was a bad time.
I mean, that sounds legit bad. Like horribly, horribly bad.
Just to clarify, Steve, you've not watched the animated shows in their entirety, right?
I have not.
So, basically, this isn't, like, an essential episode or anything, so I don't mind spoiling it. On Naboo, a separatist scientist who is voiced in, like, the most faux Nazi German way imaginable is trying to reconstruct an old virus that basically kills you in a couple hours, which is just fantastic. And then Ahsoka and Padme wind up infected, and Anakin and Obi-Wan have to go to the planet where the angels live, which is mentioned in episode 1. So that's a whole thing. Blue Shadow Virus, bad time.
It does sound, but is it as bad as Nerf Pox?
I don't even know what Nerf Pox is!
Alright, well how about the Gamorrean mumps then? Do you really want to catch Gamorrean mumps?
I mean, I don't want to catch the mumps that exist in our world today.
Right. So imagine how much worse it would be for Gamorreans.
Yeah, exactly. You getting space mumps? I don't know what's gonna happen to you then.
Gamorreans, for those of you who don't know, are the pig people in Jabba's palace.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would take, out of all three of these, I think I would just take Rat Ghoul Plague.
Just take a small plague.
Just turn me into a Rat Ghoul and call it a day.
What's a bit of a plague among friends? Which has honestly been America's response to COVID, so.
Yeah, very, I mean, true. I guess you get to become a Sith-enslaved zombie, essentially. Right. Like, that's pretty cool.
And there is a cure to Raku Plague, whereas I do not know if there is a cure to Gamoria Mumps or the Nerf Fox. So,
wait, can you please explain what the fuck Nerf Fox is? The Wikipedia page is entirely unhelpful.
That's all it is. It's just the Nerf Fox. I'm assuming it's an analog for Chicken Fox.
I mean, if that's all it is, then that's the one I want for sure.
Yeah, because that's like the easiest one to get over.
Yeah,
but it also might not be an analog, though. It might be something, like, even worse. It could be, like, the bubonic plague. Who knows? We'll never know, though, I guess.
I guess I'm 100% trading the Gamorrean Mumps.
And
yeah, for sure. That sounds miserable.
Promote the pox. Devil you don't know compared to the devil you do. I don't know how to use that saying here. And due to no other choice, I'm promoting the plague that lets me become a Sith-controlled zombie. Unless I was Force-sensitive, in which case I'm safe. All three of our listeners have at this point turned off the podcast.
So I'm on the Wikipedia page for Nerf Pox, and the only link that there is a broken link on Disney.
Yeah,
so
exactly. There's nothing. There's no information about what this is. This is totally useless.
This is awesome.
Well, I guess we should try to get our listeners back and talk about a little baseball before we go completely off the rails.
Uh-huh.
Because we did have some baseball action, some relevant baseball action this week, so we'll talk about that. The Major League portion of the Rule 5 draft, we know, as we spoke about last week, it's been postponed indefinitely because of the lockout, but minor league players are not part of the union, so the minor league portion of the Rule 5 draft still took place. And as we talked about last week, the rules are basically the same, except, you know, the players involved are generally lesser caliber than the guys that would be in the major league portion of the Rule 5.
I mean, put it this way. Take the, like, close to 0% success rate of major league Rule 5 picks, tune that down by about a factor of 100, and you're looking at Rule 5, minor league Rule 5 picks.
Yep. So the Mets made two picks, and with their first pick, they selected a right-handed pitcher, Alex Valverde, from Tampa Bay Rays. Valverde was originally drafted by Tampa in the 22nd round of the 2017 draft out of Miami-Dade College, which is a JUCO down in Florida. He was never really considered a top prospect as a high school senior, which is why he was never drafted out of high school, but he did have solid stuff. And when he did have the success that he had at Miami-Dade College, it did open some eyes. He pitched there for 1 year, and he posted a 180 ERA in 85 innings with 52 hits allowed, 20 walks, and 92 strikeouts. And he was going to transfer to the University of Alabama, but he never actually pitched there because of, you know, transfer rules and the fact that the Rays then drafted him in the 2017 draft. And they liked him because he got, as a 22nd round selection, he got a $272,000 signing bonus, which is incredibly good for someone selected that far down. I don't want to say that he's been overmatched as a professional ever since, but the numbers have been, like, pedestrian at best. In his first year at the Rays, which is 2018, he had a 4.56 ERA and 108.2 innings at low A Bowling Green. In 2019, he was basically only a reliever, and he had a 4.29 ERA and 65 innings at high A. He played in the AFL in 2019, and he was decent. And unfortunately, you know, COVID happened, so he wasn't really able to carry that momentum into 2020. This year, he pitched in Double A, and, you know, again, the numbers were not really that great, a 4.88 ERA. But if you do look under the hood and you do look at some of his peripherals, trended in the right direction. His strikeout rate, it jumped to 28.7%, which is a career high by almost 10% more. His home run per fly ball rate, it shrunk. You know, maybe that his BABIP was, you know, not great, which would explain why the service numbers were kind of, and the peripherals were all right. Maybe it's just kind of a one-year statistical noise kind of thing. Maybe there were legit improvements. Who knows? But I guess we will see next season.
I have to admit that I am way too into this guy, actually. I had him on our list where we were going to talk about Major League Rule 5. I had him picked out from the Rays system for a couple different reasons, and I'm sure none of them will pan out, but I'm legitimately interested in seeing what the Mets do with him.
Yeah, all these guys are like very big flyers and stuff, but he's at least kind of interesting. So,
I'm also a sucker for these. Almost like a Jordan Yamamoto type, and to be clear, Jordan Yamamoto is a better prospect, but there's a similarity here in that Valverde has a bunch of secondaries that are probably average, if not slightly above, already, and they work at the level he's at, but his fastball sucks, and that's kind of Yamamoto's deal, right, wherein he throws all these good secondaries, and you look at them, and you're like, man, how is this guy not having more success? And it turns out his fastball is just way too freaking hittable. So I think the BABIP and home run to fly ball issues he's had are not totally a mirage. At the same time, this is a guy who clearly has a feel for spin, even has a feel for a very good changeup. That might honestly be his best pitch. And I think there's evidence to suggest that teams are better at optimizing fastballs than ever before. Whether the Mets are is an open question, but there's some things to play with here. And I think if you can put it all together, you get like an interesting reliever or depth starter out of it. Like you basically stole it for free.
And like I think you could probably go ahead, Steve.
I say he gives me Steve Cishek vibes, like just the kind of fastball, the junk that he throws, the weird arm slot that he throws from.
Sure.
He's good against right-handers, but lefties hit the shit out of him.
But also like that was a usable reliever for a while, you know.
Cishek had like a 15-year career.
Yeah.
Like if that's what you get out of this, then like that's a huge win, like a ridiculously big win.
I think it's also. It also makes sense in terms of the org that they targeted, right? I think when you're looking at Rule 5 picks, you want to do one of two things. You want to go to either an incompetent org that that is very obviously missing someone, and that's not the Rays, or you go to like the very, very competent orgs that simply have too many guys to protect, and that's what the Rays are, right? They have so they legitimately have. Or had, I didn't follow the entirety of the draft closely, and we obviously still have to do the Major League Rule 5. They legitimately had like 10 arms and a couple infielders that I would have been, if I was the GM of a rebuilding team, I'd be like, I want 4 of these guys. Like their organization is just insane. So I think there's a decent chance that he's not someone that fell through the cracks for them. He's someone who just like they didn't have room for. But just because the Rays don't have room for you, that doesn't mean that you can't be useful.
Yeah. And, like, the Mets right now just don't have the infrastructure to be like that. Like, the Mets aren't there yet with their new regime. Like, Cohen took over in, November of last year, and it was you can't really hire anyone by then, and they've been working on all that stuff now. So, for now, just steal it from the good organizations until you could do it yourself.
Basically.
Yeah, might as well. With their second pick, the Mets selected another right-handed pitcher, Carlos Ocampo from the Cubs. He was an international free agent that the Cubs signed at a Cartagena, Colombia back in January 2016, which at the time was towards the end of the international signing period. Well, more the middle, I guess, than the end, because back then it was still July 2nd to June 15th instead of starting in July. But Ocampo's career hasn't really panned out. Some of it was just because, you know, his own on the field performance. And then some of it was because it just factors out of his control. 2017, he missed the entire year because of the Tommy John surgery. In 2020, obviously he missed the entire year because of COVID. So, you know, over the last 4 years, he's been out for 2 of them, which is not good for your development at this young an age. Basically, he has 152.1 innings total under his belt. And 2/3 of those innings are either at the Arizona complex or the Dominican complex. He has 1 year of full season ball this past season, and he posted a 5.85 ERA in 47.2 innings, all in relief with low Myrtle Beach, 15 walks, 67 strikeouts, both of which were career bests. ERA wasn't pretty, but, 5.85 ERA. But the FIP was much better. It was a 3.88 FIP, and ex-FIP was even better, 3.12. He's not exactly old. He is 23, and he'll be in high A, I assume, next year, which is not terrible. But again, just so much lost time, and he's moved so slowly when he has been on the field. So, stuff is okay. You know, low to mid-90s fastball, has a pretty good slider. He's just kind of struggled to command his pitches, and he was kind of, able to this past season, career bests with walk. But was an outlier, or is something, different? Again, I guess we'll...
He's barely played.
I mean, he's also just super hittable. Like a 350 BABIP and a 17.6 homer to fly ball ratio. That suggests to me that he's... Oh, shit. I always get this wrong. Command is ability to hit the zone, or is that control?
Yeah, command, I always define it as like you want to put the ball over here and you actually put the ball over there.
Okay, and then control is
you're actually able to, pound the zone. So you can be terrible, but if you're still throwing, if you want to throw something high and in and it ends up, down and away, but it's still in the zone, then your command is not good, but your control is at least there.
So it sounds like he has control because he can hit the zone.
Yeah, but he has
no command because it seemed like he was just throwing shit in the zone. Very Edwin Diaz, right? I'm going to throw my really good fastball and really good slider. I'm just going to kind of throw them at the heart of the plate, and you're either going to swing and miss, or it's going to be a meatball that you crush.
Or it's going to be like an accidental dot, which he does a lot of times too.
Yes.
Where like he'll throw some fastball on the corner, and we're like, well, I don't know if he meant to do that, but...
We'll take it.
It's fine. Don't worry about it. Do it again. But...
And let's see. So the Mets, they also lost a pair of players in back-to-back picks. In the third round, they lost right-hand pitcher Alan Winans to the Braves, and then they lost right-hander Tommy Wilson to the Mariners, who then traded him to the Orioles for cash considerations a couple of minutes later. Neither guy is really anyone that you're going to, cry about losing. Winans was drafted in 17th round of the 2018 draft, and then Wilson was also drafted that same year in the 19th round. In Winans' two seasons with the Mets, he pitched for Kingsport 2018, Columbia 2019, and then split 2021 with Brooklyn and Binghamton. And he has a combined, over the course of his career here, 2.64 ERA and 109 innings, over 67 relief appearances, 72 hits allowed, 38 walks, 100 strikeouts. Numbers are fine, but he's just kind of always been on the older side. He's always been one of those guys that just kind of, seems to have succeeded more because he's just throwing all kinds of things that the younger players really have never seen much before. And then when he's kind of, facing older, more experienced pitchers, he has not had that kind of success. Basically, a right-hander with a fastball that sits around 90, not going to go very far. And then Wilson, he pitched in Brooklyn in 2018. He split 2019 with St. Lucie and Binghamton. And then he missed most of this past season because of a shoulder injury. But when he was able to pitch, he pitched for Binghamton. He threw like 15 innings towards the end of the year. He's a solid pitcher, actually. But most people are going to remember him for being Biff's son, obviously. And he does a lot of NFT work, so I hope he's laundering some money, I hope.
Does Winans have a... I know Wilson is kind of a change-up dude. Is Winans a change-up dude as well? Change-up?
I don't have my notes of him in front of me. They're actually still on the physical paper. This is how much of a dinosaur I am. I use actual, pad and paper and... I always forget to transcribe it. So my notebook is on my bookshelf somewhere, but I believe he's really just a slider guy. Okay. I'm sure he has a third pitch, though. I
mean, yeah, but...
Well, my point with Wilson, though, is that he strikes me as the classic, I succeed in the low minors because I have a facsimile of a real changeup and no one knows what to do with it. And then you get to AAA or the majors and people are like, oh, this is just a changeup, dude. You got nothing else and you're screwed.
Yeah. These are, like, useful organizational guys, but,
Yep.
Like, I think the Mets went ceiling over floor here with these two picks. Like, I guess they're kind of trading the two picks out, the two pitchers for two pitchers, but they took two dudes who I could see having more of a ceiling, but also being, like, released in a year. But, like, that wouldn't be either Wilson or Winians, but they would also not make the Mets in 2 or 3 years anyway, so.
I have no strong feelings on Ocampo, but I have a fairly strong conviction that Valverde is a much better org piece or even prospect relative to Wilson or Winans.
A better bet, I guess, is a good way to put
it. Yeah, sure. However you want to phrase it. I'd much rather have Alex Valverde than either of the pitchers the Mets lost. So to me, I see this as an absolute win.
Yeah, I like Tommy Wilson. He was solid, actually, but I don't think that he really had, you know, I don't think that the major league ceiling is there, and if it is there, it's very, very, very fringy role in any kind.
Look, if your org is going to wind up crying over losing a dude in the fourth round or the third round of the minor league Rule 5, you got some bigger problems.
Oh, no. The org is not going to be crying. I might be crying. Uh-huh. We're looking at two very different things. So, yeah, that is really the only baseball-related news this week. We do have a baseball-related email, though. So we'll do that now. Matt from Maryland, he has a two-parter.
Okay.
Number one, we'll deal with each one separate. So number one, could the Mets sign Chris Bryant to a $25 million minor league contract and then purchase the contract and add him to the 40-man roster after the lockout? Yes, in theory, but no one would have any respect for Chris Bryant ever again. Yeah.
I don't even know that you can leave the union in that way. Could you? I'm not 100% sure.
I mean, yeah, you can opt out of being in the union. I know Barry Bonds elected to not be part of the MLBPA at a certain point, which is why John Dowd exists.
Yeah.
But
and Reggie Stockard in MLB The Show.
But yeah, like I Chris Bryant, he's a solid all-star, you know, in his prime, but Barry Bonds he is not, and yeah, that would not be a good idea for Chris Bryant.
Yeah, like there's been some minor league signings of major league players. I know D. Strange Gordon didn't play last year in the majors, but he signed. And Michael Franco signed. But it's like no big guy is going to cross the picket line, really, I guess is the best way to put it, to sign a minor. Like Chris Bryant's not going to do that just because Chris Bryant's going to get $25 million a year in 2 months. You know, like.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to do that. Like a guy who might not get a minor league job or major league job might have to do that, and the circumstances for that guy are different than Chris Bryant or Carlos Correa or any other big name guy, just because like everyone's just kind of gonna look at Chris Bryant and be like, damn dude, really?
Yeah. But that'd be the nicest thing to they say to him.
Yeah.
The only big major leaguer I want to see cross the picket line, I want to see Freddie Freeman cross the picket line to go sign with the Dodgers instead of the Braves, just because I'll be laughing my ass off the whole time. But that's not going to
happen. I can't believe they let it go this far, honestly.
Absurd.
Like,
you just won the fucking World Series. Give him his sixth. They're not even haggling over AAV.
Yeah.
Give him his sixth year, you fucks.
And, like, yeah, like, maybe it's not smart, but also he's Freddie Freeman. He's going to retire. Then he gets to retire a Brave and put his number up in the rafters and everything.
Exactly. He's the face of the org, so.
It's a little bigger than the on-the-field stuff sometimes, and the Braves are fucking that up.
We're diverging wildly here, but let's see. So over the last – fucking hell, Freddie Freeman put up 3.3 F4 in 2020 – in 60 games? Good
Lord. He was
Lord.
Really good that year. Like,
good
that
fucking
year.
Lord. Point is, a more normal Freddie
MVP,
Freeman... Yes. A more normal Freddie Freeman season is like 4 to 5 wins, and you're probably going to get that for like another 2 years. If you give him $180 million, you're basically paying for like 18 wins.
And then like the DH is going to come.
Probably. Yeah. Like
he gets to do that when he's old. Like,
he's almost certainly going to make good on that contract or come close. Like, it's insane. Anyway.
But yeah, he could in theory, but I just don't think in execution that would ever even be a thing that he would want to do. And honestly, he might be mad at the team that suggests that. And that might mess up negotiations later, depending on how much of a union guy he is.
And now, second part, on a more serious note, why hasn't the players' union expanded their membership to include minor leaguers? They would increase their size, the strength of the union, but what's Dan's sign that I'm not seeing?
So I think the problem is that he's wrong about it increasing the strength of the union, because MLB will not care if the majority of minor leaguers are striking. Like, they just don't give a shit. They'll be fine. Like, MLB needs major league players. They do not need... That's not fair. The system does rely to some extent on minor league players, but the amount of marginal power you'd gain relative to the vast amount of new demands you'd have to be negotiating for...
Yep, exactly that.
Not worth it for that. I mean, they should, like, to be clear. Like, morally, they absolutely should. But...
Yeah. Morally, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Deserves got nothing to do with it.
And so the way some players have talked about, like, the minor leagues, it's... Instead of it being, we should make it better, it's you should get through it, and they're just going to... A lot of people are going to have that attitude in that regard for this, too, for unionizing them.
Adam Eaton, stay retired, bitch.
Yeah, exactly. He's the guy who I think of every time with this stuff. It's
mm-hmm.
He's kind of made himself the poster boy about it because he's
the true reddest of asses.
Yeah. But I'm sure he's not alone. Like,
yeah, no, absolutely not.
Yeah, just at the end of the day, it just, you know, if you start bringing up minor league issues at the bargaining table, that's more stuff that the owners can use as leverage against, you know, major league issues that need to be addressed. And, you know, unfortunately, it's just kind of how it is.
Yep.
So I hope that's hope those are two good answers there.
I mean, at least they're providing housing now. That's a step in the right direction. But then you'd have to, like, better pay, better benefits, et cetera, et cetera. And, I mean, realistically, the players aren't even going to get the things they're already asking for, like increased minimum salary, reduction to revenue sharing. Like, it's a very frustrating situation all around, because while they absolutely should bring in the minor leaguers, I also understand why they don't.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe, who knows? I mean, things are trending upwards lately for the minor league in terms of, you know, how players are being, their, what's a good way of putting it? Their, something of life. How is that? What is that?
Quality.
Thank you. There you go. The quality of life has, you know, taken a decidedly upturn in the last, you know, couple of years. And, you know, hopefully that continues. And, you know, maybe we get to a point where, you know, it actually does become something that major leaguers then can attach the strength of their union to. But I'm not, if I was a betting man, I would say not anytime soon.
Yeah. And honestly, the only reason why we've gotten this far is because everything's too public now. Like,
right, it's the strength of the internet and people.
Yeah, social media. It's the same thing. Like, everyone's like, wow, this strike is going to be so ugly. And it's like, you didn't think it was in 1994, but no one tweeted about it, you know, because it didn't exist.
Probably better for everybody that Twitter didn't exist in 1994.
Probably be better for everyone if Twitter didn't exist now.
Yep. Very, very good point.
Next time you catch the big game, catch $10 when you sign up with Venmo. Whether you're splitting a ride to the stadium or grabbing nachos for the crew, Venmo makes it easy to share the fun and split the bill in the app. Keep track of shared home expenses like rent and utilities, or easily settle up after group activities like brunch with your buds or a weekend road trip. No matter how you choose to Venmo, payments are safe, secure, and lightning fast. Join over 76 million users and counting, and get $10 to send and spend when you sign up today with code SBNation. Offer ends December 31st, 2021. Limited availability. See terms at venmo.me/signup10. That's $10 with code SBNation.
What if you could quickly send money into your mom or your best friend's bank accounts? Sounds pretty great, right? That's what Zelle does every day. Zelle lets enrolled users send and receive money in just minutes, and it's in over 1,000 banking apps right now, so chances are you already have it. So when it comes time to pay back your brother for half the cute gift you found for your mom, or when you need to cover your share of the weekend ski trip where no actual skiing took place, pay with Zelle. Transactions typically happen in minutes for enrolled users, so you can spend your extra time getting ahead of gift wrapping or perfecting cookie decorating. Zelle is a great way to send money to family and friends no matter where they bank in the U.S. Look for Zelle in your banking app today.
All right, guys, so we have basically covered any baseball, any relevant baseball-related news on the first half of our show. So I have some news to share. I finished The Mandalorian.
Steve, all right, hold on. Let's stop. If you've not seen Mandalorian Season 2, we're going to give you, let's say, 5 seconds to fuck off. One.
I'm pretty sure I'm the only person that didn't actually see it.
So three. Good. Four. Five. All right. If you're still listening, you don't get to complain about spoilers anymore. Now, Steve, how much did you cry when Luke showed up?
I did not cry. It was a lot of mixed emotions, though. It was just like, huh. It's like an X-Wing. Oh, that can only be one person. Then it went to, like, denial. It's like, nah, they're not going to have Luke Skywalker. They can't have Luke Skywalker. Then it's Luke Skywalker. It's like, oh, shit, it's fucking Luke Skywalker. Uh-huh. And then when, you know, he has to take the baby, it's just like, oh, shit. But he has to, you know? It's like,
yeah, it makes sense.
It's just better for him.
I will freely admit that I was sobbing the second I saw the X-Wing show up because I knew it was Luke. I'm like, oh, God. That's not true. Started to tear up when the X-Wing showed up. And then when they, as he's walking across the bridge in the room with the hollow floor, basically, and you see his lightsaber, then the sobbing really started.
It's just pretty cool. And I can definitely appreciate, you know, showing off Luke's Jedi badass side, because you didn't really get to see too much of it.
Yeah. And it's a fun way to, like, kind of remind, because, I don't know, I kind of forget that there's a larger universe with The Mandalorian sometimes, because it's so, like, episode to episode, and it's just kind of him doing his own thing. And then it's like, oh, yeah, like, all this other stuff, too. Like, where you are, it's like they tied into the larger universe, which was cool. Because that's really one of the first times they did it in a big way. Because they did it in smaller ways, but this was like the big one. Like, it's Luke. You know, it's literally the face of the franchise.
I would argue to the fans of the animated show, Ahsoka was a huge connection to
that's
the
fair. That's fair.
Yeah, but this was like the connection to... Yeah. Yeah, this is a connection to everyone, right? Like, everyone knows who Luke is.
Literally, like, the most... Like, I only saw the movies and The Mandalorian Star Wars fan would be like, oh, that's Luke. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But, like, if you haven't, you'd have to get explained who Ahsoka is, even though she's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not a fan of Ahsoka. But
that's
don't really
because
have
you haven't watched the animated shows.
Yeah, I've watched enough of the animated show to... I'm decidedly neutral towards Ahsoka, but the problem is when the Clone Wars TV show came out in, like, 2012, whatever.
2008, I think.
No, that's when I think the movie... Was she in the movie?
Yes.
Really? Huh, okay. Well, still, the point is, so much Clone Wars-related media had been out already, and she didn't exist yet. So it's like, it's a meta thing, where when they finally come up with her and insert her... There's so much other stuff that she's not included that she kind of should be, and it just causes a lot of, like, weirdness.
They handle that extremely well.
They do. I would say they make it make more sense than you would think. Because that's a good point. Like, she should be in everything because of how important she ends up being, but...
I'm surprised that they haven't made, like, you know, George Lucas hasn't gone back to make a special edition of, like, Attack of the Clones that features a scene with her in it or something.
So it's funny you
mentioned
that.
She's in it for 1 second. She nods from across the room.
Right. she looks at Anakin. Anakin looks at her. They're just like, hey.
Yeah, they just walk by in the hallway. Like, so oh, who's that? Oh, that's Ahsoka. Cool.
Two things on that front. One, the sequels are really bad, but she was in Rise of Skywalker as one of the disembodied Jedi voices. So was Kanan. which I didn't know until recently.
That's the best part of the movie, to be honest.
Oh, yeah, it's the only good part of the movie. Yeah. By best part, you mean only good aspect of the entire film.
I do.
I guess the lightsaber fights are good, too. Choreography-wise. Two, the point you're making, Steve, is actually handled really well. So if you don't know, Clone Wars aired, like, there were 5 seasons on Cartoon Network, right? Mm-hmm. I think it was Cartoon Network. Got canceled. A brief 6th season on Netflix, canceled again. Then there were a couple years of nothing. Then there were 4 seasons of Rebels. And then finally, like 2 years ago, they finally made season 7 of Clone Wars, at which point we see how she integrates into Revenge of the Sith, and it's also done extremely well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm telling you, you just gotta commit to it.
They handled it with enough care. Like they didn't, like, they realized your point, Steve. Like, they realized that a lot of people would agree with you because it's the truth. Like, it's what she should be. Like, retroactively, she should be in it. But, like, they do handle it with care. Lucas is correct.
I don't remember where I'm up to in the Clone Wars. Because it used to be on Netflix, so I started to, like, marathon it because I hadn't seen it, and then it got taken off of Netflix when Disney Plus, I guess, got created, so I stopped. I just finished Mandalorian, so I picked it up. I was going to pick it up anyway, but I was watching it with my mom, and I was just like, well, if I'm going to pick up where I left off, which was, I think, season, like, the end of season 4, beginning of season 5, I know she's going to question, why the fuck is Darth Maul walking around? So I was like, all right, you know what, since she's here watching, let me go back to, like, the 2nd season where they bring back Darth Maul so she at least understands what's going on here. So I haven't actually picked it back up yet, but I will soon.
Maul in the animated show is fucking fantastic character.
Oh, I hate him. I hate it. I hate the whole
thing. What? Sam Witwer needs to be in everything forever. I don't care. He's so good at everything he's been in, I love.
I just don't like the idea. Like, he's dead. Just leave it alone. He died. Goodbye. The end.
Well, they messed up by killing him, to be honest with you.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Yes and no.
Because my dream prequel thing is that Maul was Vader's master. And Maul was the reason why he turned Vader, like, he turned Anakin into Vader.
Uh-huh.
And at the end, Vader has to, like, do the Sith thing and kill him. Like, that's how I would have written the prequels. Because he's such a good character that there's no reason to kill him after one movie. Like, I feel like it's just a waste of him.
It was totally a waste.
Like, it's so stupid.
Dooku was lame as fuck.
Exactly. He was just an old pretentious man. He had a cool lightsaber, that's it.
Like, pretty much.
I'll say this, the way Maul... How to phrase this? I agreed with you, Steve, at first, where I was like, this is stupid. Why they're out of ideas that they're bringing back, but the tragedy that plays out with his life, particularly with how it culminates in Rebels, which you've seen,
yes,
is just some of the best storytelling in Star Wars. I think
it really
just
is.
The arc of Maul between Clone Wars and Rebels is almost perfect.
Man, I want to watch all this again.
I guess I'll see it. My initial reaction, like I said, was I thought it was just kind of dumb. They brought him back. And from what stuff I do know of, you know, the kind of stuff that he does and the direction that his life takes him in, he just seems a little too Mary Sue-ish. But, again, I don't know the details, so that just might be some, you know.
Did you meet the Night? So you saw how the Night Sisters on Dathomir work and how Savage was created, right?
Right. Yes. Yes.
I mean, I think that's part of the justification for why Maul was so strong, and also he was just a very strong Sith at one point.
Yes, he was. Also,
I don't know.
Yeah. Again, though, like I'll have to actually watch everything and see. Because from just kind of vague details I know, it's just like, oh, wow, okay, Maul literally becomes, like, the head of the Black Sun and of every single pirate group, and he just basically becomes, like, the kingpin. And it's just like, eh.
Now, Thomas will have to comment on this. Without spoiling the actual participants in the fight, Thomas... 3-way battle on Mandalore, best lightsaber duel in the series.
Ooh,
It's pretty good.
Yeah, it might pretty be. Good. It's so good. It's
pretty,
so good.
Pretty good.
I don't know if it's what you're referring to, but I know that there is, like, what I am really looking forward to is when he does eventually, like, confront Palpatine.
Ah, yes, that's what we're referring to, yes.
Okay, yeah, like, I know, like, that got hyped, and I was like, alright, yeah, that is kind of cool, because...
It's a fucking fantastic fight.
Where I'm at right now, it's just, like, he is not really acknowledging, like, how he's just kind of abandoned, and, you know, not yet really much anyway, so... Yeah, obviously there's some sore feelings.
Mm-hmm. The way they turn a character that all of us should hate, be angry at, there's actually a great, like, behind the, or like a director's commentary scene where he's talking about the significance of Duel of the Fates and all that, and how Maul basically made Vader by killing Qui-Gon and removing the father figure, et cetera, et cetera. So a figure that we should objectively regard with, like, intense anger turns into someone that you feel nothing but pity for by the end. It's like, man, it's I feel bad for this guy.
It's funny that some of the best writing in Star Wars is, like, tucked away in the animated shows for kids.
I don't think it's even some of it. I think most of the best Star Wars storytelling is Dave Filoni's work at this point.
And, like, because it is for kids, because they make it obvious that it is, and that's fine. Like, it's still enjoyable, so I don't really care. But, like, none of this is saved for the movies.
No.
Not anymore, no. Really.
I mean, the unfortunate thing is that they gave the movies, the sequels, to people who didn't give a shit about Star Wars, and it turned out bad. And, yes, there are a lot of people who complain about them just because they don't like the fact that Rey's a woman, and those people are dickheads, but also at the same time, the sequels are bad.
Yeah, listen, you're not going to get an argument from me about that.
Even, I mean, it's a kid show, but even the episode about the Zillow Beast, right? They're presenting a real moral dilemma of, is it right to kill this unique organism to protect more people? Like, that's a legitimate moral dilemma in a kid show. Spent like 10 minutes debating this in a kid show.
Yeah,
John Stuart Mills approves. Yeah, so what are the things happen to Mandalorian? Obviously Boba Fett, but, you know, we know that depending on your what you regard as canon or not, but we know that Boba Fett, you know, lives. It's cool to see Boba Fett being Boba Fett, because as we've kind of mentioned on Slack, the Boba Fett fandom that grew from his 5 minutes in Empire Strikes Back and 5 minutes in Return of the Jedi was very disproportionate.
His first appearance was the holiday special, right?
Yes, as a cartoon. And that version really resembled the Mandalorian of the Mandalorian than Boba Fett.
Jesus Christ.
They could do a lot of cool stuff with the Book of Boba Fett, but also, like, all of his hype is projection. But also now they could be viewed as, like, they could actually do that stuff. So I'm actually looking forward to it more than I thought I was.
I am actually of the opposite opinion. I am surprisingly not that interested, but I'll watch it.
I'm mostly interested not to be like, oh yes, I love Boba Fett, but more like, what do you do with a character that so many people have hyped up based off, like, not much? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
there's so little actual screen time for him. Uh-huh. And that now we're about to get, like, eight episodes or 10 episodes. I don't know how long it is, but it's going to be hours of content for him. It's the most he's ever been on it in our faces. So
what's the time frame for that supposed to be? What do we
right after if, season two?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's like in between two and three, I think. Right. Like
in between season two and three of The Mandalorian. Yes.
Yeah.
I had tepid interest. But I'm a little worried by what I've seen in the trailers. That one line where he's saying he wants to rule with respect instead of fear, I'm like, that's you're going to make mean. Boba Fett a good guy?
Yeah.
That's not what...
he was a bad guy, yeah, obviously, in the movies. And then, again, with the fandom, when it kind of appeared and people started liking Boba Fett, he kind of became somewhat of an anti-hero.
That's what he should be. Like, they should make him an anti-hero, and he played a good, quote-unquote, good guy role in The Mandalorian, but that was because he had a debt to pay, and that made sense.
Yeah, right. He had reason to.
Right. He's like, he has a code, I'm gonna pay my debt, and I'm gonna fuck off, fuck you. I'm worried they're gonna make him another goody-two-shoes.
Yeah, it's interesting. It really is. Like, they could do so much, and it could be either good or bad. Like, I really don't know how it's going to be. Like, I'm pretty confident Mandalorian Season 3 is going to be good because the first two are and the same people are involved. I have no idea how this is going to go, and that's kind of fun.
That's fair.
I mean, I'm so overhyped for Ahsoka, series, especially with the hints at where that's going, given who they've cast, that I almost don't care about Boba Fett. I'm like, yeah. Just get this done and move on to the shit I want, please.
What about Obi-Wan?
I also kind of don't care.
Yeah, I don't care either, really, but I'm going to see it. I'm going to watch it. I don't care just because, like, I don't know. Part of the whole mystique of Vader and Obi-Wan in the fourth movie was, like, they haven't seen each other in years. So why are they both in this series? You know what I mean?
Like, yep, I agree.
I'm worried that they're gonna ruin it and they're gonna like meet a bunch and like interact all the time and
I was thinking about that and I agree. And I was thinking about that and I was talking to my mom about it and at first I was just like, yeah, that's dumb. Like if they actually meet, which you know they're going to, and have some kind of confrontation, like that kind of ruins their meeting in episode 4. Yep. But at the same time, you would think that, you know, once Anakin became Darth Vader, he knows that, you know, Obi-Wan put him in the situation that he was in. You would think that he would go nuts, overturn everything, looking for Obi-Wan.
Oh, so in the comics, he basically is eternally looking for Obi-Wan. He just can't find him.
So if they do have some sort of, like, conflict where he then now thinks, okay, Obi-Wan is dead, it would make sense then that he can go on for the next 15 years or so until episode 4. And then, like, oh, shit, I'm sensing a presence I haven't felt in such a long time. What the fuck, Obi-Wan? Instead of, I've been searching for you past 20 years, and even though I am literally the second most powerful person in the galaxy, I couldn't figure out that you are hiding right under my nose, you know, across the street from my mom's old house.
Literally.
So I think the problem with my enthusiasm about the Obi-Wan show is that in my head, he's a broken man who's literally hanging out in a hut in the desert. He has one job. He has one job only, and it's keeping Luke safe. And I don't really, at least in my head, he's not doing anything else. But, I mean, again, I'll watch it and see where it goes.
Yeah, the scope of the show really needs to be very local-ish. You can't have Obi-Wan flying around going, you know, different
planets. He hates flying anyway.
Right, exactly.
But the good thing is, like, the Star Wars Disney Plus stuff has gotten such a cachet for me that I'll watch pretty much whatever. Because all of it's been good. Like, I've enjoyed all the series, so I will give most of the series a chance just because they haven't failed me yet.
One super cool thing that they thinking about it just all, you know, just popped in my head now that they could go to, which would be pretty awesome, is there in the expanded universe, and this was a meeting between Obi-Wan and this other character on Tatooine. He is a Tusken Jedi. He was a human. Mm. He was a human, but he was adopted by Tuskens.
What the hell is his name, Steve? I can't remember it.
I mean, he became Darth Krayt in far, far in the future.
Yes.
What the hell is his name? Now that's annoying me.
I'll look it up while you continue your thought.
But there was they basically did come to blows while he was after, you know, during the Jedi Purge, Asherad Het, that's his name.
Yep.
Obi-Wan and Asherad came to blows, and that, you know, because Het was a survivor, and he was justifiably angry, and he was like a dark Jedi at this point, and he was rallying the Tusken Raider clans to raid human settlements and everything like that, and he was going to be basically, he basically got too close to Luke and the Lars homestead, so Obi-Wan had to put a stop to that. So that if they take that story from the EU and adopt into the Disney canon, that would be pretty cool.
Sure. I think they're going to do a lot of EU stuff just because it's already there for you, for them to do it. And they could pick and choose what they actually want at that point and boot all the other stuff that's like, because there's a lot of stuff that you don't need.
I also, on a semi-tangential note, but somewhat related to Obi-Wan v. Vader, I read this interesting passage from a book, like an excerpt from an EU novel I'd never read, that was Yoda sensing the Vader-Obi-Wan fight in New Hope, and how he just feels this horrible loneliness in Vader after he kills Obi-Wan. I'm like, well, that's interesting. If we're going to get some deeper exploration of, like, Anakin's tortured soul immediately after becoming Vader, I might be interested in that. But, again, in Filoni we trust. God, could you imagine how good the sequels might have been if Filoni made them?
We could have done so much.
We would have had, like, a three-movie arc of, like, Thrawn leading the Empire remnant from the forbidden unknown regions.
That's what the sequel should have been. The heir to the Empire trilogy.
Yep. Instead, we got the shit we were handed.
Well, they both had really goofy clones, so I guess that works. There's some similarities there.
Well, we are. Well, Steve, if nothing
No, wait. Palpatine wasn't a clone, though, right? And he was just inexplicably alive for some reason.
He was basically a clone that he cast his spirit into as he was falling down the shaft. It made no sense.
Okay.
No fucking sense. Perhaps the best impetus, if you're a Thrawn fan, to watch the animated stuff is to appreciate they basically recreated EU Thrawn. And, like, Filoni was like, no, EU Thrawn's too good of a character, he's going back in the canon, and he put EU Thrawn back in the canon.
He is that good of a character.
And it's incredibly well done, I think. And now he's going to be the antagonist in the Ahsoka series, so it's all there. It's all good.
Should be good. Was he in charge of the writing of the Clone Wars cartoon, Filoni?
The 2003 one?
The 2008 one.
The movie, yes.
This is the movie and then related series.
Yeah, so that's him. Yes, and so and then Rebels as well, and also Resistance, which sucked, but no one cares.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, I mean, one thing that, you know, he is not perfect, and he completely fucked up Mandalorians.
I think the Mandalorians are more interesting now. I thought the EU Mandalorians were boring.
They were Spartans, basically. Like, how's
that's
that
so one note. Like, there's no depth to that.
That's what they were. It doesn't have to be depth. They're just basically dumb killing machines.
I don't agree. I think there's much more nuance to their society, as depicted in both Clone Wars and in the Mandalorian TV show.
I like how the TV show, The Mandalorian, basically addressed the very weird differences between what group of Mandalorians and how they acted, and then basically every other Mandalorian in Star Wars canon, that whole thing with, you know, not taking off the helmet and being weird recluses and everything. And then, what's her name? The blue...
Bo-Katan?
Yes, Bo-Katan. She's like, yeah, you grew up in like a weird-ass cult. It's like, oh, okay, that's a good way of rectifying everything there.
Yeah, they were basically like, well, some of you are. Some of us are.
Some of us are normal, and some of us like you are just weirdos. Yeah, but yeah, one that basically is my biggest issue with like all the Mandalorian stuff. It's just how different the Mandalorians were depicted in the show and the cartoon, and how it just kind of screwed up, like, all the other continuity that was already there and caused a shit ton of, like, headaches. Like, huh, Mandalore used to be, like, a forested jungle planet, and now all of a sudden it's, like, a desert planet, and it was kind of technologically low, and now all of a sudden we have, like, giant dome cities. And
yeah, it's a desert planet because there are endless wars. Fuck the environment. It makes sense.
Well, that's something that they had to add in to try to rectify everything, because literally everything was so different. And I give credit to, you know, the guy that used to do all that kind of stuff, Li Linqi, who was in charge of, like, fixing continuity errors. That was a good one. But it also didn't.
That would make sense, yeah, like, logically.
Right, what they came up with was, like, 200 years before, like, you know, around Battle of Yavin and everything, like, the Republic just got sick of the Mandalorian shit, and they just basically firebombed the entire planet. And
I mean, I think that's a pretty reasonable explanation, given the kind of dickheads they were.
Right, oh, no, Mandalorians definitely dicks, and they definitely deserved it. But, again, then when you have books that were written prior to the Mandalorian show and Clone Wars cartoon that depict Mandalore or take place on Mandalore or have Mandalorian culture as very, very, very radically different, it's just like, well, come on, guys. Like, you should have been referencing this stuff.
Yeah.
So, I honestly think that's why they made all the expanded universe stuff non-canon when Disney...
Oh, yeah, no. Like, so Disney could just have free reign to do what they want, and then
yeah,
because the stuff they do, like,
honestly, a lot of stuff has been happening is stuff that's already in those expanded universe things. Just mm-hmm. because
can we also speak frankly about the EU for a second?
If you're going to say that most of it was trashed,
there's a lot of shit in the EU.
Yeah, there's a lot.
I would say 25% shit, and then 75% good.
I would flip those percentages, Steve.
No.
Because it's so big, and there's so many things that they did for so long, and it was so left unchecked because it all was canon.
Everyone and their mother wrote an EU-sanctioned Star Wars book, basically. There's a lot of bad stuff.
There's a lot of stuff that's just...
Off the top of my head, give you one really bad... Two really bad books. The Crystal Star... Yeah. And Dark Saber.
Yeah.
The original Dark Saber, not the black lightsaber thing, Dark Saber.
Speaking of which, there is now a replica of the Dark Saber, and I very much want one for my lightsaber display.
Mm.
My hypothetical future lightsaber display.
Well, do we have any other points to hit on here about Star Wars before we move on?
Steve, you finally relented to Thomas and I, and to be frank, it was mostly I, because I'm an annoying asshole about this kind of stuff, but Thomas and I, and started playing Mass Effect, and that's gone pretty well for you. Maybe you should listen to us and watch all the animated shows. I'm just saying, you know,
I never said that I'm not. Honestly, the original hang-up I had with the Star Wars, with the Clone Wars cartoon, this is years ago, was I always watched it with my ex-girlfriend, and then she broke up with me, and there was, I'm a very emotional person, so I was just like, I can't do this, I can't even watch this.
That's fair.
Now, I think, you know, 5 years later, I'm ready.
Hey, Steve, we'll be your emotional support Star Wars fan.
Thank you, I really appreciate that.
But before we go, since we're indulging in our fandoms here, any Mass Effect updates?
Would you guys get really angry if I say it's kind of boring?
Are you still in one?
The game is rough.
Are you still in one?
Yeah,
have you recruited all the companions?
No, I haven't played it in like a week and a half, probably 2 weeks.
Hmm. So the first one, it's an old game, and it feels old sometimes. Yep. Like, I don't know if when I play it again, I will go back to one when I play it again, like the next time. It's just old. Like, two is really... Once you're past it, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
Like, I promise you that.
The last thing I did was I went to... I don't even remember the name of the planet, but it's basically where I'm driving around. I got the vehicle when I'm driving around on, like, the snow and the ice.
That thing
cannot... Did you do that before recruiting Liara?
I don't... Yes, I think so.
Oh, you should have gone to recruit Liara first. Oops.
Oh.
Did you recruit Tally Garrus Rex?
I don't think so, because...
How did you leave the Citadel without recruiting Tally Garrus and Rex?
I don't know. Wait. Who's on my team? I'm using the big, scary, bounty hunter-looking alien guy.
Does he look like a frog with a hunchback? That's Rex.
Okay, so, yeah, and then I also have, like, the guy that's the same species as the guy that I'm hunting down, the evil guy.
Garrus, yes. Okay. Garrus is the ultimate bro. There's no shepherd without Vicarian. Starts sobbing uncontrollably. carry on. Did you recruit the girl with the helmet?
Yes.
Oh, Tali. You got all three of them. Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
All right, so you got those three, and you have Kaden and Ashley. You should go to... What's the planet, Thomas?
Is it on Mars? No.
No. You get her on Mars in Mass Effect 3. In Mass Effect 3, it's on...
She's in the science thing. In the archaeological dig.
Fuck. We are a recruitment Mass Effect 1. Finding the Artisoni, blah, 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 protein.
She's on Therium.
Is that the planet?
Therium in 1. Yeah. Which I don't even remember. Oh, no. She's in the Gnosis system in Therium, yeah.
Right, she's in an archaeological dig.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If possible, Steve, when you go back, I would go grab her before proceeding on Nuviria, because her mother is the person you're tracking down on Nuviria.
Yeah, it's good story stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I will.
It's like the games are weird where you could do things in whatever order, but also you should do things first sometimes.
Right, yeah, it's an optimal.
It's very BioWare.
Yes. Yeah. Where, like, it's open world, but also, like, you could kind of mess up, especially in 2, because you could just, like, miss people completely and stuff.
Oh, should we tell him about the consequences in 2, Thomas, or should we let him find out on his own?
I mean, I found out on my own the first
time. All right, go let him find out on his own.
I guess I'll find out on my own.
Sure. Well, I'm gonna say this about 1, Steve, and I'll stop after this, because I know I go on. You're right that it's slow, and if you're not, like, a hardcore fan, I can understand not playing. You don't need to do all the details, just focus on the main story missions, and also between missions, walk around the ship and talk to all your crewmates.
Yeah, that was kind of what was burning me out. I was doing all the side quests on the Citadel, and, like, after an hour, hour and a half, I'm just like,
You don't have to. It's very grindy. It's old-school RPG stuff,
yeah,
right?
It's old in that regard.
The most important thing in playing 1 for a new fan, I think, is making the connections with Liara, Rex, Garrus, and Tally, and fuck the two humans. They suck.
That's pretty much my...
yeah, because they'll be recurring characters, and if you build the connection early, it's more meaningful later.
All right. Well, good to
Steve's
know.
Steve's walking around for 3 hours scanning the keepers. And it's
The fucking keepers, yes, man. That quest is the worst. Every time I play the game, I've always missed 1, and it's always the same one.
I missed one the last time, and I was
fucking
like...
time.
I was up till like 2 a.m. one night, like, no, I'm doing this tonight. And I was texting my friends. I was like, I don't think this exists. I think my game's broken.
I always miss the one that's off to the right on the platform in the council chamber. Every single time. I'm going to forget by the time I play it again in 2 years.
Yeah, for real.
It's like in Fallout when you're in the pit and you need to collect the 100 silver ingots. It's basically impossible.
Or the Crimson Nurnroot in Skyrim.
Yep.
Oh, wow. Jeez. I haven't thought about that in a while.
I always install a mod specifically to turn that sound effect off, and it's a fucking lifesaver.
Well, that's a good segue, I guess, to the Wilponery of the Week. And the Wilponery of the Week is anyone that scans all the keepers or collects all the Nurnroots or finds all the ingots.
How is that Will Ponnery? Because I'm the person who always does all of those
things.
I feel personally attacked right now. I thought we had some real Will Ponnery this week.
We do. The Will Pons of the week are Ice Arizona Hockey LLC, who happen to be the owners of the Arizona Coyotes. And they are also the owners of over $1.3 million in unpaid state and city taxes.
They finally did pay them like 2 days later because they got counted.
Yeah, they basically basically the city was going to kick them out of their stadium.
They got publicly shamed. It's amazing that this is the point we're at, where we have to publicly shame powerful groups into paying their fucking taxes.
They said it was a clerical error that caused them to not pay the
taxes. And I'm the Queen of France.
It's a clerical error that's like millions of dollars and years of unpaid taxes. And they were like, yeah, we're fine. We're good. Don't worry about it. And everyone was like, okay.
This is not the first time they've had quote-unquote clerical errors either, because apparently they've stiffed vendors before. They've had even player payments issues. So
they've like bullied vendors into like lowering their costs and stuff. It's a very bad operation down there. It's real rough.
Now imagine
the Coyotes were decent actually as a team.
They started to get analytically they went in that direction where they started to get smarter, and then they were bad and fired everyone. So that's how that went.
That also sounds extremely Wilpon-y. Are we sure they aren't actually owned by a distant Wilpon relative?
It is a possibility.
But yeah, it was a thing for a while, and people thought it was going to be like finally them coming back, and they were like, they made the playoffs like once or twice or something. I don't remember. This was also, I'm getting my timelines mixed up because they are not a successful franchise overall. Mm-hmm. And then like they hired this really young GM, and he was like 30 and like really analytically inclined, and they didn't really beef up the analytical office around him, and then they fired everyone. And apparently the front office culture was like awful. So that's how that's going down there. And they might move to Houston. So that's how that's going.
Oh, boy.
It's a really bad operation down there. It's rough.
Yep.
They have good jerseys, though. So.
Yeah, they do have a good logo.
Because they changed it back pretty much to the 90s one.
I just wish the Kraken were better.
I mean, they'll draft high this year, so that's fun.
Mm.
But they hired, like, their GM's like Ron Francis, like a 60-year-old.
I don't know enough about hockey yet to understand how to root for a bad team.
it's
hard.
You watch your goalie get stranded, and then you pick a good winger or center in the first round. That's it. That's what happens.
Got it. Understood.
Well, let's go Rangers.
I refuse to root for a Dolan team. I don't need that in my life.
Only one of them is good at a time, and the Knicks have been bad this year. So that's all you need to know.
I refuse to immediately burden myself with the shackles of a Dolan fandom immediately after the universe deemed me worthy of being relieved of Wilponery. That's me throwing a gift. That's me begging the universe, saying, "No, I don't want this good thing. Take it away."
Very good point. All right, well, if anyone has any questions, comments, whatever, you could send us an email at our email address from complextoqueens@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Twitter and shoot us questions there. I'm at Steve Slipa. Lucas is at elvlahos343. Thomas is at sedmethseasonszn. And Ken is at ken1191. Subscribe to the podcast wherever you get your podcast from. Rate and review it. And of course, we thank you for listening. And we will be back next week. Maybe we'll talk about baseball. I don't know. Who knows?
If there is baseball things to talk about.
If there is baseball. So until then, love the Mets. Love the Mets.
Next time you catch the big game, catch $10 when you sign up with Venmo. Whether you're splitting a ride to the stadium or grabbing nachos for the group, Venmo makes it easy to share the fun and split the bill in the app. Sign up today with promo code SBNation and get $10 to send and spend. Offer ends December 31st, 2021. Limited availability. See terms at venmo.me/signup10. That's $10 with code SBNation.